Good afternoon. It's Monday the 25th of March 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. Apologies for the slight delay, a bit of a problem getting the stream started this morning for some reason. But anyway, let's get straight on with it, Patrick, because, well, over the weekend, what did we have? All kinds of shenanigans going on here with Theresa May and Brexit. An emergency meeting held at Chequers with people like Boris Johnson, Ian Duncan Smith, Steve Baker, Jacob Rees-Mogg, David Davis, and a number of others. And all kinds of rumours that she was going to resign. In fact, at one point we were told that she had resigned. That didn't seem to be the case. And certainly today it looks like most people thinking that she isn't going to in a hurry. So various media over the weekend calling this a coup attempt. The coup has failed, apparently. Well, this gentleman was due to take over as interim prime minister, potentially, although when he was asked about it afterwards, he said, I'll tell you this, one thing that working closely with the prime minister does is cure you completely of any lingering shred of ambition to want to do that task. So this perhaps reiterates once again that there's nobody in the Tory establishment around Theresa May that actually wants to take this job while this Brexit furore continues. But nonetheless, we should note that David Lidington, as I say, was tapped for the job if Theresa had resigned. He is Cabinet Office Minister, and that really would have been a coup because that would have meant that the Cabinet Office in absolute complete control. Nigel Evans, though, perhaps expressing it in an interesting way, said clearly a number of people do not want the Prime Minister anywhere near the next phase of negotiations, which is the future trading relationship between ourselves and the European Union. Well, it's actually a lot more than that, because remember that the withdrawal agreement that all the furore is about at the moment is only the first half of what's going on here. This is the divorce section. Then you have to look to the political statement on the future relationship with the EU, and that's the bit that still has to be renegotiated.
So this phrase of Brexit, it's only the end of the beginning.
It's only the end of the beginning. I think we might be coming on to a little bit more of the end of the beginning later on, but we'll get to that. In the meantime, over the weekend, of course, we had the million person march. What has the European press been saying about this? This is Le Monde. They're saying historic demonstration in London for a second vote. They're saying that this is a country where protest is not the norm. So this is pretty significant as far as they're concerned. Libération as well, saying that peaceful and good-natured was how they described the protest. And what if, after all, life was simpler than Brexit was their position. And if we go to Germany, Die Zeit, saying that at the end of one of the most dramatic weeks in British politics in many years, May's negotiations with the EU have failed. She's lost control of the Brexit process and the danger of a no-deal Brexit looms. Well, does it? We had this from Liam Fox this morning saying we either leave the European Union with a deal or we leave with no deal, which is possible, but I think Parliament makes that unlikely, or we don't leave at all, which I think would produce a democratic as well as a constitutional crisis. Well, we've talked about constitutional crisis quite a bit over the last couple of days, and we'll just make mention of the fact that the Foreign Office Minister, Mark Field, has admitted apparently that he would be quite keen to support the idea of revoking Article 50 and seeing if Theresa May's deal is voted against. So Liam Fox, once again, talking about constitutional crisis. What is the nature of that constitutional crisis? We'll come on to that in 1 second. Just mention that the Europeans' position here is that we can avoid a no-deal Brexit. I believe we will avoid one. That's according to Pierre Moscovici, who's the EU's Economic Affairs and Tax Commissioner. Perhaps he knows something about the deal that was done last week with Theresa May. And as I've said before, when she gave her press conference after midnight on Friday morning, she had a smile on her face. She was quite happy. She didn't look under any particular pressure. But let's get back to the constitutional crisis, because this is what it's all about, really. This is from Friday. And it's from Tim Barrow to the who's the UK representative to the EU in Brussels. And he said, I refer to the draft European Council decision taken in agreement with the United Kingdom extending the period under Article 50 as attached to this letter. I'm writing to confirm that the agreement of the government of the United Kingdom to the extension of the period under Article 50 and to this decision. So just to remind everybody, there were two dates offered by the European Union on this. The first is April the 12th, if Theresa May's deal doesn't go through, April the 11th, April the 12th, that overnight. Then May the 22nd, if Theresa May's deal does go through. But there's a pretty major problem here, and it is this, as we pointed out on Friday's programme, the European Union Withdrawal Act 2018. And Chapter 16 of that says that exit day means the 29th of March 2019 at 11 p.m. Now, that 11 p.m. UK time, of course, is midnight EU time, and that is why that time has been chosen. But nonetheless, this date has been written into legislation. It is the law in this country, and therefore nothing can change that. But the problem is that Theresa May seems to be taking the position that because that letter was written to the EU, agreeing to the dates that the EU proposed, that that then makes those dates applicable under international law. That may well be the case, I don't know, but the fact of the matter is it doesn't change anything with respect to UK law. And if Theresa May and Parliament are going to pretend that this doesn't exist, what we see on screen at the moment, if they're going to proceed on the basis that the new dates proposed, which is just a proposal by the EU, are effectively real, then there is a constitutional crisis in this country, Patrick. So I thought I would have a look at the parliamentary business for today. Well, here's the House of Commons report, summary agenda for the chamber. And if we read down through that, we find that there is a section there for statutory instruments, motions for approval. And I thought, well, okay, perhaps there's going to be a statutory instrument laid down to be voted on by Parliament to make a change for the dates. But the problem with that is, of course, we don't know which date is going to be the date yet, because they haven't had the vote on the meaningful vote for the third time, supposedly. So let's look at the detail of that then. So here is the business for today. And as we scroll all the way down through here, we eventually get to discover that they will be debating Section 13 of the European Union Withdrawal Act. And of course, Section 13 is nothing to do with the date of leaving at all. Section 13 is all about parliamentary approval for any deal. So there's some amendments going in about that. That's all happening tonight, and there's going to be votes at around 10 p.m. tonight. Okay, so we scroll on down and we find, well, what? That there's a whole bunch of statutory instruments which will be laid in the event that there is time, and if they're not, they're going to be deferred, but none of them is with respect to the date of leaving. And so, Patrick, I'm saying that there is indeed a constitutional crisis, and it is on the basis that Parliament appears to be ignoring the law. They say that we live in a parliamentary democracy. They say that Parliament is sovereign, and yet at this point there's no mention of when they're going to make this change. And the point is that it takes about 48 hours to as a minimum to lay a statutory instrument and get a vote through both Houses of Parliament, the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And therefore, if Theresa May doesn't bring her third meaningful vote before, say, Wednesday, then there isn't time to amend this legislation. So, yeah, they constitutional crisis, government seems to be implying that they can just ignore the law when it suits them.
On top of the constitutional crisis, don't you see the tremendous irony here, Mike, that this particular constitutional crisis is so representative of the whole premise of Brexit? So what is the law of the land according to the British Parliament? Is it what it says on the Brussels document, international law, or is it what is on the UK's own
statute books?
Statute books.
Yes.
Isn't the irony there just too much to even ignore, I think?
So indeed. And the point is, as Ned in the chat box asking, so technically we leave on the 29th. Not technically. We leave on the 29th if this statutory instrument is not placed and voted upon and passed before the 29th.
According to UK law.
Absolutely.
So, and if not, then you have officially a constitutional crisis.
Correct.
Not debatable.
No, indeed.
By the letter of the law.
Correct. Now, speaking of constitutional crises, is it too much to suggest that Russiagate and the Mueller investigation has been tantamount to a constitutional crisis?
We're orders of magnitude beyond that by now, Mike. This is a national crisis. This is a definitive moment in U.S. political history here. The Robert Mueller's report has been turned in. Of course, we've talked about this for the last couple of weeks, said it was going to be DOA. Those are the words I used on the Sunday Wire, dead on arrival. And of course, that's exactly what happened. So the Mueller report is finally here, Mike. And fortunately for the Democratic Party and for the Never Trump lobby, the report recommends no further indictments and finds no Trump-Russia collusion, no Russian collusion, basically. That's it. So here we are two and a half years later from the investigation. And
how much money?
Well, on paper, they're claiming it's $25 million, but I think it's substantially more than that. But it's not just the money, Mike. It's the amount of political capital that's been expended. It's the amount of time that has been devoted to this by legislators, congressmen, senators, bureaucrats, civil service, and the media. The amount of the value in media time that has covered this non-event. It was an event, but there was no underlying crime ever, okay? We knew this from the beginning. But think of all the resources that have been expended on this, Mike. Could have been allocated towards so many other different issues. Healthcare in America is just one example.
So one of the criticisms of Brexit has been the fact that everything has stopped for Brexit. No other parliamentary business going on. And in fact, perhaps some things going on under the surface that we aren't aware of because of the noise created by Brexit. Is it fair to say that in the United States, you've had exactly the same situation with no proper political process, no new legislation of any particular note, because everybody's been so focused on nothing?
In that sense, Mike, it's very, very similar. The only difference is Brexit was real, and Trump-Russia collusion was not. So that was the only difference, a little bit of a reality. So let's look at some of the talking points here with sort of the bones of contention. So the Donald Trump appointed a new attorney general, Bill Barr?
William Barr. That's
sorry.
It, yes.
Sorry, needed your help on that. William Barr. So let's look at what is the argument point here. So the Attorney General Barr is not neutral. This is what the opposition are saying. So here's Ron Wyden. This is the senator from Oregon, ultra-Democrat, senator from Oregon. So he's basically saying that Trump nominated the Attorney General Barr, who's turned in this report here from Robert Mueller, and saying that's why he made him Attorney General, because, well, he's going to favor Donald Trump, basically. So the argument here is obstruction. Donald Trump has obstructed this investigation.
Okay, well, how is it possible for them to make this argument when William Barr is best buddies with Robert Mueller? William Barr's wife and Robert Mueller's wife attend the same Bible meetings. They are very, very close. So how is it possible that there's any suggestion that Trump has put him in this position because he's a Trump fan?
Well, that's true. So that sort of knocks down the argument that Bill Barr wants to take down Robert Mueller in his investigation. So the more basic answer to that, the more obvious answer might be that there's so few actual neutral people left in Washington that they had to dig deep into the barrel to find somebody from George H.W. Bush's administration And mind you, the Republicans were much more moderate back then. It's not like the new breed of neoconservatives. I think across the board, everybody in government was more moderate back in the 80s.
The good old days of George H.W. Bush.
The good old days. So let's look at the reaction from this. The reaction from the media has been total meltdown over the last couple of days. So this is the Mueller media meltdown. Let's take a look at this. So here's what's been happening. So the reframing is already gone. Now it's not the, what Mueller reports released to the Attorney General Barr is the end of the beginning for Trump, not the beginning of the end. And you hear this repeated over and over on multiple reports. You've seen that video that went viral a few months ago, Mike, where it was Sinclair Media had given a script to all the local news, syndicated news outlets, and they all repeated the same talking points nationwide. So this is happening over the weekend in the United States. This is the end of the beginning for Trump. So it's so they're saying they're only getting started. So that's NBC News right there. And so you can see this on a number of reports. And if we move into the Mueller media meltdown charade, so the end of the beginning, mark that down. That's your talking point. You need to learn that and have that emblazoned on your brain, on your cortex, okay, going forward. So this is CNN, and I'm just going to show you the level of manipulation here. It's very subtle, but most people won't notice it unless they're looking or they understand what CNN is. So emboldened, Trump's presidency enters a new era. The headline is actually very true. The president is very emboldened, as is his base. But look at the graphic below. Let's take a closer look at that graphic below. What does that say? Conspire or coordinated with Russia in its efforts to influence the 2016 U.S. presidential election. So just from a visual point of view, when you see that as a main graphic flashing on screen with CNN, you'll think that somehow this report contains that accusation and that that's one of the final conclusions of the report. This is how CNN operates. It is subliminal, it's propaganda, and even though the report has come back exonerating the president and all of his associates for collusion with Russia, CNN is nonetheless putting forward a different subliminal propaganda campaign here to give you the opposite conclusion of what's actually in the report. That is CNN at its finest. And this has been going on all weekend across many of the media outlets. And that ticker tape along the bottom, that's called the Chyron. Okay, that's been full of deceptive messaging, just like this. So sort of half-baked talking points to make you think that actually Trump is guilty of colluding with the Russians. So you want to explain?
Well, so this is the letter that that was sent from the Attorney General. And, well, here is the quote that CNN has lifted. And when you look at the full quote, you discover the context is somewhat different because the full quote says, "The special counsel's investigation did not find that the Trump campaign or anyone associated with it conspired or coordinated with Russia in its efforts to influence the 2016 U.S. presidential election." So that is somewhat different. They simply chopped the key contextual part of that sentence off, put a dot, 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 an ellipsis at the start, and implied that implied the implication was clear that Trump had conspired or coordinated with Russia. And so even in their defeat, they insist on flogging this dead horse.
Yes, it is incredible there. So we've just shown you just one example of many. Bear in mind, there's an absolute tsunami of this type of deception going on over the last 48 hours.
So the next thing, the next question was had he committed any kind of crime? Had he in any way prevented Mueller from doing his job? And again, the report here absolutely clear. The special counsel states, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, well, it also does not exonerate him. Now, this became a major talking point as well in the mainstream press over there. But of course, while Mueller has said that it doesn't exonerate him, you still live in a common law jurisdiction, and therefore there's a presumption of innocence.
Well, you would think that, Mike, but leave this on screen. I just want to point out that's not the case anymore. This, what you've highlighted here, Mike, looks to me, I would call that a bullet left in the chamber.
Right.
In other words, that's a political caveat that's been added as an addendum onto what is the conclusion of the report. So this is just basically sowing doubt, just leaving it out there, letting it hang out there. And so the media have looked at this, and that's just a pound of red meat for the media. And they're going to feed off that last phrase, Mike, for at least the next couple of weeks, and it will fuel all sorts of speculative reports. So we're so looking forward to all that. So, and so continuing with the Mueller media meltdown, let's look at what's next. This is a good example here in terms of Exhibit A and Exhibit B, a little lesson here. And let's look at Exhibit A, BBC breaking news. President Trump campaign did not conspire with Russia during the 2016 election. Robert Mueller's report says, wow, I'm actually giving credit to the BBC here for accurate reporting and not spinning this. This is a very rare occasion on the UK column, so do take note, everybody. You might want to screenshot this. Exhibit B, the Associated Press, breaking Justice Department letter, Mueller does not exonerate Trump of obstruction of justice or find that he committed a crime. Is that, what level of deception is that? Can you make that one out, Mike?
That is a pretty carefully crafted tweet, it has to be said.
And what would be the effect of that Associated Press statement?
Well, the effect is, if it's carelessly read, the effect is to put in the minds of the reader that he's not been exonerated, therefore he has got some kind of crime to answer for.
He's guilty, basically.
Yes.
So the BBC actually wins here. So the BBC has been exonerated in a way. So good reporting by the BBC. Well done, well done. So continuing, well, that's fake news on the part of Associated Press. Fake news for the AP. Sorry, guys. So moving on, Mueller's marks. Now, this is important here. Who are Mueller's marks? Let's take a look at these gentlemen here. Michael Flynn, George Papadopoulos, Rick Gates, Michael Cohen, Paul Manafort, guilty, 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 guilty. All of these are Trump campaign officials or associates, and they've been all found guilty. Now, the opposition have said, well, these are the results of the Mueller investigation. Trump is dirty. Crimes have been committed. This is a completely corrupt White House. But we have to point out to everybody, those are process crimes. These are crimes which have resulted from the investigation itself. Just in the case of Michael Flynn, he was illegally recorded with a bogus FISA warrant during the campaign. And so when he went to testify with the Mueller investigation, he wasn't aware he had already been wiretapped. And so his statements on the wiretap months before didn't match up with the statements he gave to the Mueller investigation. And suddenly they arrested him for lying to the Mueller investigation, or in this case, lying to the vice president was the specific charge. So these are process crimes. There's no Russian collusion with any of these associates above here. Now you have to ask the question, Mike, if you knew there was no Russian collusion beforehand and you saw the things that they're getting them for, which is not filing taxes correctly or sort of financial paperwork or lying to Congress, so that none of these crimes would have happened if not for the investigation, which we now find out was started on a false premise, basically. There was never any Trump-Russia collusion. So if you just targeted them on those technical process crimes, that would look like political targeting, wouldn't it? It would look like a witch hunt, right?
Well, indeed. And in fact, if you're suggesting that Trump, or if, not you, if Mueller is suggesting that Trump has not been exonerated for impeding the Mueller investigation, but there was no, there was nothing to investigate in the first place. How is it possible to impede an investigation which is based on nothing?
Well, this is the point of this whole obstruction talking point.
Right.
It would be like accusing someone of a resisting arrest for resisting a fake arrest or resisting a wrongful arrest. And you can't charge them with resisting arrest if it was a wrongful arrest because they were in the right. So in this case, Jay Sekulow, who is Trump's personal attorney, basically said that their legal position is there's no underlying crime. This is from the Attorney General's office, we're told. There's no underlying crime, therefore there's no obstruction. Mm. So you can't be guilty of obstruction if there was no underlying crime to begin with. And that seems to be the case with the release of this report. So, and there's moving on to Mueller's marks here, and we'll look at the next one. Here is 12 Russian agents indicted in the Mueller investigation. Everyone remembers this story. These are the Russian hackers, the GRU hackers working out of a boiler room in St. Petersburg, the Internet Research Agency, doing all sorts of nefarious things, putting up Facebook ads and the like. So they were somehow indicted via this investigation. So this is kind of a meaningless indictment, Mike, because A, they're never going to stand trial in the United States. You can indict as many people as you want in a foreign country, and it's not really going to mean anything. They haven't actually produced any actual evidence of any crime. They claim they put malware onto DNC servers and all these sort of things. So there's a lot of accusations here. And this particular article has these sort of graphics where they're claiming that Russian intelligence officers hacked the email accounts of Hillary Clinton. They're so careless that they left their fingerprints all over it, supposedly, but we can't really see the evidence. They used online personas and WikiLeaks to release stolen emails and documentation. That's the claim. That's the whole basis of this. Hacked into computer networks of the DNC. That's the key one. Hacked into the DNC. That's one of the foundational pillars of the entire investigation. Okay, the Russian interference, Russian collusion investigation. Mind you, Mike, even if they were GRU hackers, and even if they did hack into, they're not breaking Russian law. And also, people do this. Don't tell me that the British and the US governments don't do this as well. So this is what they do. So even then, it shouldn't be out of the ordinary. The real question is, did they change the outcome of the election? Mm-hmm. Was it their objective to change the outcome of the election? They can't even show that there was intent to change the outcome of election. They say, quote, to sow chaos amongst what does that mean? Sought to sow chaos, sought to influence. What does this mean? This means nothing. So they can't even say that they interfered on behalf of any one candidate. So that point alone is ridiculous. But this has been carried through these talking points for the last 2 years. This just shows you how far we are away from reality. Let's go back then, and the final point on here, let's look at this, is on Mueller's marks. The claim of the DNC hack, well, it just so happens, Mike, that last week on Consortium News here, Veterans for Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, this is a group led by former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, and this report was released last week, Mueller's Forensic Free Findings, okay. What does this report prove? Well, let's look at what they found. We have examined 500 DNC email files stored on WikiLeaks site, okay? And what did they find when they observed that these data show that the DNC emails posted by WikiLeaks went through a storage device like a thumb drive, where which were physically removed before WikiLeaks posted the emails on the World Wide Web. So what they're saying here is that it's not possible that they were hacked remotely. And why is that? It has to do with a type of a metadata signature known as FAT, FAT files. And they said that the speeds were so great, it would have to have been a local transfer. It couldn't have been a remote hack. So it would be a physical impossibility. The findings of this report by VIPS have been verified by two former NSA technical advisors, not one, but two former technical advisors of the NSA, heads of technical NSA department, okay? Mm-hmm. One of them is William Binney, which many people might be familiar with. This is what they found. So what does this mean? Well, this means that the DNC was a leak, not a hack, in the summer of 2016. That is kind of a big deal, Mike, because that changes the entire narrative altogether. So not only do we not have Russian collusion with any members of the Trump team or any associates or any cabinet members, we don't have any of that. So now we don't even have a DNC hack. Okay, so what did the Russians do? Did they do anything? Well, so far there's no evidence that they did. And if you want to dig in a little bit deeper to that story, go to Consortium News. So in summation, in terms of what we found here, Russiagate, Trump-Russia collusion, the last 2.5 years of complete 100% monopoly of media coverage and political capital expended and time spent, money spent. And what do we have with this whole story? What is this? 2.5 years of what?
Fake news.
Yeah, actually it's fake news. And what, I'm going to go even further. This is the biggest political hoax in U.S. history. You are looking at the biggest political hoax ever in the United States. And they're going to keep milking it as much as they can. But my final takeaway point, Mike, is Donald Trump is going to use this as like when you roll up a paper and he's going to whack the Democrats over the head with this and CNN for the next 2 years. And the Democrats were hoping this would be the stick they're going to bludgeon Trump with going into the 2020 elections. But now Trump has that in his hand and he's going to continue whacking them with it right through the election. This is devastating for the opposition, for the resistance. This is a complete defeat for the resistance. They're going to keep fighting on. They're going to keep pretending that there was Russian collusion and so forth. But there's no evidence that's going to come forward, Mike, because as we both know, if there was any actual evidence, it would have been on the table probably during the election in the last 2 months. I mean, they wouldn't leave something like that sort of laying around for later after Donald Trump got elected. So there is no evidence. We said that from the beginning, and we'll stick with that.
Okay. Okay. Well, now one of the big things that Trump has been campaigning for since he was elected was the wall with Mexico, and of course, many people suggesting that this is all about immigration. Well, it's part of it, but it's not the main part of it because Trump has made clear that the opioid crisis in the United States is a very big part of that as well, and he wants to try to stop, particularly fentanyl, which is this synthetic heroin, from getting into the United States. But of course, before people get hooked on heroin or synthetic heroin, they're on prescription painkillers, opioids. So I just wanted to highlight this article in the Mail. This is about the Sackler Trust. Now, the Sackler Trust is owned by the Sackler family, or run by the Sackler family, but they own, some of their members own Purdue Pharma, and Purdue Pharma produces the prescription painkiller OxyContin. And this is one of the gateways towards some of the harder opioids in the United States. It is highly addictive, and a number of people, there's a class action basically against Purdue in the United States at the moment, and this is causing the Sackler Trust a little bit of embarrassment. And in fact, a lot of the organizations that the Sackler Trust has been funding are now refusing to accept their funding. So, for example, the National Portrait Gallery, the Tate Museum, have both said that they won't accept any more money. And so the Sackler Trust has suspended making any new, what they describe as philanthropic giving, while they deal with these hundreds of lawsuits over Purdue Pharma. Now, the statement from the Sackler Trust is, I'm deeply saddened by the addiction crisis in America and support the actions Purdue Pharma is taking to help tackle the situation while still rejecting the false allegations made against the company and several members of the Sackler family. Well, we will watch that one with interest, but there's certainly a British angle to that. Now, let's head over to Israel. And of course, this video released by the Israelis, the IDF, today, alleging that a rocket, a missile, has been sent from Gaza into Israel and has hit this property and injured a number of people living there, including children. Well, seven people injured, apparently. But as Sputnik is reporting here, Israel has now sent troops to the Gaza border. They're saying that the development comes after the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu cut short his trip to the US on Monday after at least seven people were injured when the rocket fired from Gaza struck a residential building in central Israel. They've deployed two infantry brigades and armored units to the Gaza border. What do you imagine is going to happen under those circumstances, Patrick?
Well, I can tell you what's going to happen. Think of the timing of this, the one-year anniversary of last year's Right to Return March, right around the end of March, so March 30th. So the timing of this, Israel military buildup on the border, well, the unofficial border with Gaza, and the Right of Return protesters are going to be out in their thousands, Mike, unarmed. And we have to remind people that over 200 people, I believe, were killed last year, I think. Is that correct?
I don't remember.
I don't know. I don't have the totals in front of me, but Robert Inlakesh was on the Sunday Wire last night, and he detailed a lot of these transgressions, much of which are included in the UN Human Rights Report, which was just released recently. So we're looking here at a perfect storm, potentially, in terms of not just clashes, but many deaths, in fact. So we'll see how this plays out in the next week.
Okay. And then heading over to Venezuela now, and this was being tweeted out today. More Russian soldiers unload in Venezuela to help prop up President Maduro. The Aleutian IL-62M was used to carry military personnel and frequently flies troops from Russia to Syria. Indeed, it stopped in Syria on its way from Russia to Caracas. So quite a number of media outlets reporting this morning that a Russian flag cargo plane and an airliner were spotted at the airport outside Caracas. So people expressing concern that 100 soldiers led by General Vasily Tonkashkurov, I got that one in the end, head of the Mobilization Directorate of Russia's Armed Forces, had disembarked this plane with 35 tons of equipment. So is this the media driving something up, or is there something real going on here? What sort of efforts are the Russians actually making to stabilize the Maduro government? That's what
I think it's both, Mike. I think the media are going to play up anything, any interactions with Russia and Venezuela. They're going to get amplified, especially by Western media and Western observers. But we also have to point out that Russia has made concerted moves to help Venezuela. One of them is by Venezuela moving the sort of international commercial operation of its state-owned oil company and moving some of those operations to Moscow in order to avoid having asset seizures and arrests and so forth as a result of punitive sanctions by the United States that wants to keep Venezuela or keep the government from earning any income from its international oil operation, bringing that back to Caracas. So Russia is doing a lot of direct actions to help stabilize not just the government in Venezuela, but ultimately this would help the people of Venezuela. But that's not how it's being framed by the John Boltons of the world. The narrative in Washington from the neoconservatives and the Elliot Abrams of the world is that any income made by Citgo or the Venezuela state oil production operation is going straight into the pockets of Maduro, of course, and that's all they do. They just pocket all the money. Yeah. Every penny that the state makes, it goes to Maduro and his cronies. So that's the fantasy fiction that's constantly being peddled right now out of Washington. So beware of that.
Okay, now, on Friday, Trump pushed this out, this tweet. It was announced today by the US Treasury that additional large-scale sanctions would be added to those already existing sanctions on North Korea. I have today ordered the withdrawal of those additional sanctions. That was a pretty spectacular move, announced on Twitter once again, Patrick, and once again showing the schizophrenic nature of the Trump administration, because the administration does one thing and he says, no, we're not having that. We'll stop that immediately. And I don't know whether he issued some kind of executive order and reversed it straight away. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with that was that when the sanctions were originally put in place, I'm only putting this article on screen just so that you can see the place. But when the sanctions were put in place, Kim withdrew his staff from the liaison office that had been set up between North and South Korea. Well, actually, it's just on the North Korean side in the border town of Kaesong. And so he had withdrawn the North Korean staff from this in response to the sanctions being placed. Well, it's been announced today, Patrick, that as a result of Trump's action in revoking those sanctions, that staff are now heading back to that liaison centre, and perhaps we're seeing a positive response to Trump's actions by the North Korean government.
Well, I think it's worth pointing out, Mike, that the sanctions that Trump pulled, revoked, basically, were being crowed by John Bolton just 2 days earlier. He was celebrating, "We have put a whole new raft of sanctions on North Korea. We're going to show them that they won't be able to do any maritime trade with the Chinese.
Right.
We're going to stop them, stop the North Koreans." And then Trump intervenes, as we showed you on this tweet, and says, no, I'm pulling those back. So Trump must have got word from Pyongyang that that was a potential deal breaker, at least for this phase in the negotiations. So are we looking at a true tit-for-tat there? Are we looking at an internal split between Bolton and Trump? Because let me just throw this out real quick. Now the Mueller report is dead and buried, okay? It's the teeth have been pulled out of it. Trump has a free hand with the neoconservatives, the national security state. Many of these people have been imposed on him because he's been seen as a damaged goods. No one wants to serve in the Trump candidate, so of course the warmongers came in and colonized it, right?
So that was going to be my next question. Is he going to resign at this point?
Bolton,
yeah.
It's possible, Bolton. You could see some major shuffle, as a result of the Mueller report coming back empty-handed. You could see a cabinet shuffle. You could see some of these characters being edged out because they're hugely unpopular, and they're giving the opposition, they're giving Democrats huge targets to shoot for during the 2020 election. So that's where Sanders and Gabbard, and they're going to be firing right at Bolton, you know, and some of these maniacs that they've got in the White House. So if Trump might want to clear them out and put some sane people in, some sort of, you know, half-human cabinet members in instead of the
whatever they are, yes,
creatures they've got now.
Indeed. Okay, well, look, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining me today, Patrick. Thank you for joining us. Constitutional crisis in the UK, all kinds of similar behavior going on in the United States. Is that a coincidence? Not sure, but anyway, we will be back at 1 p.m. as usual for more on Wednesday, and hope to see you all then. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.